Ayabhutale, Srimate Bhaktivedanta Swami Nityanamane, Namaste Sarasvati Deve, Gauravani Pacharane, Nirvasesa Sanyavadi Paskachyade Satarane, Vande Ham Sri Guru Sri Yutapadakamalam, Sri Gurun Vaishnavamscha, Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatham Vitam Stam Sajivam, Sadvaitam Sadvadutam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam, Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Sri Vishakam Vitamscha, Vanchakalpachubhishchakipasindivyevatapatichanam Pavanevyo Vaishnavevyo Namo Namaha. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. February 15, 2023, in Hawaii, reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 5, Chapter 10. The discussion between Jetabharata and Maharaj Rahukana, text 20. And we have a Sanskrit letter here that's actually very, very rarely used. We think about, you know, some English letters aren't used very much, like a Q and Z. But this one even more rarely, the lr is hardly ever used anywhere. Sabaivala loka nirikshanartam. Avyaktalingo vicharatya pisvit. Yogeshwaranam gatim andabhurim. Katam vichakshita grihanubandha. Saha.
Saha.
That Supreme Personality of Godhead or His Incarnation Kapila Dev.
Vai.
Indeed.
Indeed.
Bhavan.
Bhavan.
Your good self.
Your good self.
Loka nirikshana artam. Just to study the characteristics of the people of this world.
Just to study the characteristics of the people of this world.
Avyakta lingaha. Without manifesting your real identity.
Without manifesting your real identity.
Vicharati.
Vicharati.
Are traveling in this world.
Traveling in this world.
Api svit. Weather.
Weather.
Yoga Ishwaranam.
Yoga Ishwaranam.
Of all the advanced yogis.
Gatim.
The characteristics or actual behavior.
Characteristics or actual behavior.
Andabhurihi. Who are illusioned and have become blind to spiritual knowledge. Katam. How? The Chakshita. May know. Griha Anubandha. I who am bound by attachment to family life or worldly life.
I who am bound
by attachment to family life or worldly life.
Muted. Unmuted.
Srila Prabhupada's translation. Is it not a fact that your good self is the direct representative of Kapila Dev, the incarnation of the Supreme Personality of Godhead? To examine people and see who is actually a human being and who is not, you have presented yourself to be a deaf and dumb person. Are you not moving this way upon the surface of the world? I am very attached to family life and worldly activities, and I am blind to spiritual knowledge. Nonetheless, I am now present before you and am seeking enlightenment from you. How can I advance in spiritual life? Srila Prabhupada's purport. although Maharaj Rahugana was playing the part of a king. He had been informed by Jetabharata that he was not a king, nor was Jetabharata deaf and dumb. Such designations were simply coverings of the spirit soul. Everyone must come to this knowledge. As confirmed in Bhagavad Gita 2.13, Dehi no smenyata dehe, everyone is encased within the body. Since the body is never identical with the soul, the bodily activities are simply illusory. In the association of such a sadhu as Jetabharata, Maharaj Rahugana came to the awareness that his activities as a royal authority were simply illusory phenomena. He therefore agreed to receive knowledge from Jetabharata, and that was the beginning of his perfection. Tad vignartam sagurun eva vijachet, Mukunda Upanishad 1.2.12. A person like Maharaj Rahugana, who was very inquisitive to know the value of life and the spiritual science, must approach a personality like Jetabharata, Tasmad Gurum Prapadyeta Jignashu Shreyam Uttaman Bhagavatam 11.3.21. One must approach a guru like Jetabharata. That doesn't mean that you have to approach somebody who's walking around without bathing and acting like they're deaf and dumb. One must approach a guru like Jetabharata, a representative of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, to inquire about the goal of human life. Savai bhavaloka nirikshanartam avyaktalingo vicharatyapi svit yogeshwaranam gatimandabhuri katam vichakshita grahanubandha. Is it not a fact that your good self is the direct representative of Kapila Dev, the incarnation of the Supreme Personality of Godhead? To examine people and see who is actually a human being and who is not, you have presented yourself to be a deaf and dumb person. Are you not moving this way upon the surface of the world? I am very attached to family life and worldly activities, and I am blind to spiritual knowledge. Nonetheless, I am now present before you and am seeking enlightenment from you. How can I advance in spiritual life? So here we see Maharaj Rahugana taking shelter of Jetabharata, basically asking to become a disciple. And in this verse, he is giving some of his qualifications for being a disciple. Particularly, he's saying that he is blind. Andabuddhi, I don't have knowledge. I'm blind to knowledge. Griha anubandha, I'm attached to my home. But I want spiritual knowledge. I want to have that. Yes. I want to have something higher. I want to have enlightenment. So, if we're listening to the Bhagavatam, I'm going to assume that we either are already disciples of a guru, or that we would like to be, or at least that we're exploring the possibility of actually taking on discipleship and taking a spiritual life very seriously. And this is the aspiration of a sincere spiritual seeker, to become a good disciple, to become a good student. I mean, such is the case if we want to learn anything at all. You know, the other day, my granddaughter was teaching her cousin's son how to work a computer. And so the young man, I think he's like 10 or 12, so he had to be very eager to learn. He had to be very eager. If he wasn't eager to learn, if he didn't want to learn, then he wouldn't learn anything. I mean, such is the case. Oh, again, we want to learn anything. And you want to learn how to tie your shoes. You have to study from somebody, and you have to pay attention. I mean, even if we're just going to the internet and typing in, you know, how do I do this? How do I do that? Then one has to pay attention. One has to be eager. I know myself, sometimes I've wanted to know how to do something, and I find an instruction video, and then it's playing on my computer, and then I'm getting distracted, and I'm thinking, oh, I got to rewind that, listen to it again. What did they say? What did they say? That I wasn't actually attentive. I was hearing Vaisheshika Prabhu say the other day, you have to show up. You have to have a desire. So I thought this verse would be a good opportunity for us to say, let me evaluate my qualifications as a disciple, if we're an aspiring disciple, to evaluate, am I worthy to become a disciple? And if we've already formally taken vows as a disciple, how good of a disciple am I? Is there some way that I can do what is needed to achieve the purpose of discipleship, which is love of God? Right? This is the reason that we become a disciple, because we want to fall in love with Krishna. We want that ultimate enlightenment. So am I actually doing that? How good of a disciple am I? How qualified am I? So I wanted to look, first of all, Rupa Goswami in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, 1.2.15, quotes Bhagavatam 11.28 as to what is the qualification for taking up bhakti. Now, he's looking here at sadhana bhakti in general, but vaidhi sadhana bhakti in particular. So to follow the process of bhakti according to the rules and regulations of the scriptures. And who's qualified to do that? So I find it very interesting that he quotes Bhagavatam 11.28, because this really brings out a lot of what King Rahugana is talking about. It seems, though, that King Rahugana is positing himself not exactly in line with this verse, and this whole thing sort of intrigued me. So if we look at the verse that Rupa Goswami is quoting, it's Yadrichaya mat katado jata shredo stuya puman na nirvino natikshato bhakti yogosya siddhida. If somehow or other by good fortune one develops faith, we have the word shredo, katado jata shredo, faith in hearing and chanting my glories, such a person, being neither very disgusted with nor attached to material life, should achieve perfection through the path of loving devotion to me. Now, again, I think this is interesting because King Rahugana presents himself as very attached. And if one's very attached, one's not actually qualified to take up bhakti, according to this verse from the Lord. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, in commenting upon this, says that nati shaktaha means devoid of extreme attachment to body, house, and family. Na nirvina, not detached, means if the person is completely disgusted with sense objects, he's qualified for gyan, not bhakti. And if he's too attached to sense objects, he's qualified for karma. You know, perhaps you've thought about why there's different systems of enlightenment. I mean, there's ordinary karma, which just means working as a pious person. There's ordinary gyan, like studying science and psychology. There's ordinary yoga, trying to get mystic powers. And there's even ordinary bhakti, which is, you know, you're worshiping for some material purpose. Most religions are in that category. And then there's karma yoga, gyan yoga, dhyan yoga, and bhakti yoga. So karma yoga is for a person who's very materially attached. Somebody who's really, they're not willing to give up their designations, sarvapad, even your muktam. They're not willing to give up those designations. They're too attached. I am a good Indian housewife. You know, I am a successful Brazilian businessman. Whatever, and they're not willing to give those up. So karma yoga is you do that for the satisfaction of the Lord if you're too attached. And we find that there's many religious systems that teach karma yoga. There's a number of purports where Prabhupada says that he's teaching bhakti yoga and karma yoga, which I find fascinating. But karma yoga has this, you're not giving up your designations, and unless you give up your designations, you're not going to receive ultimate enlightenment. You may get to the heavenly planets, or you may even have some connection with the super soul in the spiritual planet in this universe. But unless one gives up one's material designations, one cannot achieve ultimate enlightenment. So karma yoga means you're doing things according to your designations for the satisfaction of the Lord. And again, if we think of so many religious systems in the world, that's what they're teaching. You know, be a good family man, to satisfy God. If they're just teaching be a good family man, it's karma. But if they're saying be a good family man to satisfy God, that's karma yoga. then we have, suppose somebody's utterly detached. They're completely disgusted with material life. They don't want anything to do with material life. Then they're qualified for Gyan Yoga. And Gyan Yoga is different from ordinary Gyan because in Gyan Yoga, one's trying to attain enlightenment. Generally, the goal of Gyan Yoga is merging with the Brahman. And Gyan Yoga is very popular today. I would say that most of what passes for religion today is Karma Yoga, perhaps with some bhakti. And most of what passes for spirituality today is Gyan Yoga. And Gyan Yoga is detachment. That one isn't attached to anything, to pleasure, to pain, to happiness, distress, fame, infamy, and so forth. And this Gyan Yoga has become extremely popular in the world. In fact, I would like to suggest that many people who become disgusted with Karma Yoga and religion, they're very attracted to Gyan Yoga. And there's many teachers of Gyan Yoga, they don't call it that, but there's many teachers of Gyan Yoga who become multimillionaires and very, very famous at teaching these systems of enlightenment where one detaches one's mind from anything in the world and from any kind of identification in the world, from any kind of thoughts or feelings in the world. But it's interesting that there's no mention here by Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur of the qualifications for Dhyan Yoga. Although I was listening to a class this morning where Prabhupada was talking about that those who can perform Dhyan or meditative yoga generally have to live for a very long time. Also, we find, according to the Yoga Ladder, it's those who have reached perfection in Karma Yoga or Gyan Yoga who are qualified to perform Dhyan Yoga. And one can go to Dhyan Yoga through either track. So if one becomes an accomplished Karma Yogi, they are then qualified to practice meditation, and if they become an accomplished Gyan Yogi, they're qualified to practice meditation. The reason for that is to be able to practice meditation, you already have to have a peaceful mind. If your mind's not peaceful, you cannot meditate. And as Krishna explained in the 12th chapter, the result of Karma Yoga is shanting. Trajak shantim kalevaram, that after you give up the fruits of your work, you become peaceful. And the result of Gyan, Gyatvamam Shanti Michiti, the result of Gyan is also peace. So Dhyan Yoga is a higher step for those who become perfect in Karma Yoga or Gyan Yoga. And again, it's interesting that Maharaj Rahugana is presenting himself as in the attached category, which would technically make him qualified for Karma Yoga. It's interesting, though, that Jad Bharata seems to be teaching him bhakti with Gyan. He's teaching him a lot of detachment. He works very hard going on in this narration to detach him from all of his material attachments with the forest of material enjoyment. Now, bhakti, one should not be either too attached nor too detached. Why is that the case for bhakti? Because in bhakti, again, we can't be too attached. We have to be willing to give up our designations. We have to be willing to identify Jivaraswara Paya Krishnara Nityadasa. Now, we do find that here in Prabhupada's purport today, where Maharaj Rahugana, Prabhupada explains, it's not in the verse, but it's in the purport, that Maharaj Rahugana is trying to digest this teaching of Jadabharata, that they are not really a king and a deaf, dumb, blind person. That these are designations and that their real identity is spiritual. So that's the opposite of karma, of the qualifications for Karma Yoga. Sarvapati Virmuktam. I don't have any designations of this world. But why not too detached? Because we have to use the things of this world in the service of the Lord. That is bhakti. Bhakti is not just simply removing oneself from the world and being detached from all thoughts and feelings. Bhakti is connecting with the spiritual thoughts and feelings. Now, of course, the elements of Karma Yoga are apparently in bhakti. Arjuna is still fighting. As Arjuna appears to be in the Varnas, a Kshatriya, and in the ashrams a grihastha. He appears to still have those designations, a male kshatriya grihastha. But he's not fighting in that respect. He's fighting as a soul, as a servant of Krishna. But superficially, it seems that way. So in bhakti, superficially, it seems like the elements of karma yoga are still there because we're using our nature in Krishna's service. And superficially, it seems like the elements of jnana yoga are still there because one has to become detached from happiness, distress, heat, cold, fame, infamy, honor, dishonor. One has to practice that control of the mind. But we do that to please Krishna, not to become liberated. And we delve into the spiritual thoughts and emotions. Whereas in Gyan Yoga, one is trying to make the thoughts and emotions zero. One is just trying to make the spiritual thoughts and emotions nothing, to be so detached from them. I remember reading something from this woman who was so expert at detaching herself that she basically didn't have any awareness of her material thoughts and feelings anymore, practically at all. But the devotee, while having almost no awareness of material thoughts and feelings, is absorbed in spiritual thoughts and feelings. And too much detachment makes that very difficult. Leshodita kataratesham, avyakta shaktitetasam, avyakta hikatir dukam, dehavadbir vapyate. And Prabhupada talks about, in the beginning of the 12th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, how if one becomes successful at total detachment from material thoughts and feelings, first, without engaging in bhakti in the beginning simultaneously, then to take up the thoughts and feelings of bhakti will be difficult. Whereas in the practice of bhakti, one is simultaneously nourishing spiritual thoughts and feelings while developing detachment and non-identification with the material thoughts and feelings. And too much detachment, is the person is not going to be willing to do that. But that's not the only qualification, not to detach, not to attach. One also has to have faith. Krishna is saying in this verse, Shraddha, one has to have faith. So King Rahugana is having faith. He's asking these questions. These questions are indicative of his faith that Jad Bharata is a worthy person. And again, this is this concept that there has to be faith is true if we want to learn anything. You know, I have to have faith in my GPS if I want to get to my destination. I have to have faith in, you know, anyone who's teaching me anything. I have to have faith that they know what they're talking about, or anyone who's giving me advice for anything. If I don't have faith in them, it's a joke. And we all run into this sometimes, that people ask us for advice, but they don't have any faith in us, and so as soon as we give advice, they immediately reject it. It's just a waste of time. I'm sure we've all had experience of people who come to us repeatedly with the same problem that we've given them advice for 20, 30 times. I remember this one devotee was coming to me often with the same questions, and finally I said, look, I said, why don't you make a chart, write down the list of your questions, then write down the list of my answers. Then write down what you actually did based on my answers. And then write down the result you got from doing what you did based on my answers. And if you have that chart, we can look at it and see, you know, maybe some things aren't working for you and we can look at something else. Well, he never did that. He simply stopped asking me any questions. But in other words, a person has no faith. They're just wasting your time. Help me with this, help me with this. Teach me how to do this, teach me how to do that. But they have no faith. So one has to have faith. Now faith shouldn't be blind faith. King Rahugan is having faith in Jad Bharata, basically because of what Jad Bharata has already said. He's working on the assumption that someone who can say the things that Jad Bharata has said, that there must be some realization behind that. But there's another very, very important item that Rupa Goswami gives. In addition to quoting that verse from the 11th canto of the Bhagavatam, well, it's actually in that. Faith in hearing and chanting my glories. Not just faith in the person. But in the previous verse, 1214 in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. Tata Adhikari. Who is the Adhikari? Who has the Adhikar for Bhakti? And Rupa Goswami, he's talking about Rati. He's talking about having a taste. He says, the person who has developed faith, and again we have faith, in serving the Lord by impression, arising from previous association with devotees, who is not too attached to material objects, nor too detached. Ati bhagyena, by extreme good fortune, has some impression, has some inclination. Right? One has to have some impression, some inclination, and some taste. Some ruchi, some rati. That one actually likes Krishna. If there's no liking of Krishna, then why would one take up bhakti? One would take up some other process. Yes? And I've told this story many times, how Ravindra Sarup Prabhu was traveling, or he met up with Tamal Krishnamurti's and Vishnu John's traveling party. Or they came to his temple, maybe they came to Philadelphia temple, and they were doing an event in the park. And Ravindra Sarup asked Vishnu John Maharaj and Tamal Krishnamurti, so how do you decide who to spend time with? And they said, well, we sit down and we have a kirtan, we hand out prasadam, and then we walk around the park while people are taking prasadam and listening to the kirtan, and we say, what do you think of the music? What do you think of the food? And if they say, oh, it's okay, yeah, whatever, then they go on to the next person, and if the person say, oh, it was really very nice, then they talk to them. So this is discussed by Rupa Goswami a little earlier in 1145, where he says, Swapani ruchir eva syad bhakti tata van odika yuktis tu kevala naiva yad asya apratistata. Even if one has a little taste for the topic of bhakti, he can understand it. He who tries to understand bhakti by dry logic cannot understand it, because logic is insubstantial. And I think this point is extremely important. In the next verse, Rupa Goswami says, a person more skillful at logic can bring about a conclusion different from what was carefully proven previously by another skilled logician. In fact, this particular point that Rupa Goswami makes is one of the main reasons that I was looking for spirituality beyond my upbringing. I was trained in debate, and in debate I learned that whoever won the debate was not who had the best argument exactly, but it was who was most skilled at using logic, and that any point could be countered and then countered. I remember reading somewhere that Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu could do that, that he would present a point and then counter it and then counter that point and then counter that point. But that's what I learned, that if you're trained and you're skilled, that you can go on with logic forever and you never reach a conclusion. I mean, bhakti is logical. There's no doubt that bhakti is logical. But it's not a question just of philosophy. It's a question of taste. Therefore, Rupa Goswami uses the word ruchi. So one has to have faith. Let's look at these qualifications. One has to have faith. One has to have a shraddha, one has to have a taste, one has to have ruchi. One cannot be too attached. If one's too attached, one should go to karma yoga, because one won't be able to work without designations. One should not be too detached. If one's too detached, one should go to gyan yoga, because if you're too detached, you can't use yukta vairagya. You can't use things in Krishna service. So if one has these things, faith, taste, neither too attached nor too detached, then one can associate with devotees and become a disciple. So we've been looking at the general qualifications for taking up bhakti by going to Rupa Goswami and Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. And now let's again actually turn to Rupa Goswami in his Upadeshamrita verse 5. And particularly we're going to look here at Srila Prabhupada's purport. Srila Prabhupada's purport, he has a whole section where he writes about the qualification for being a disciple. And Prabhupada lists a number of points. I picked out 7 of them. Well, we could say perhaps there are 8. So losing interest in material enjoyment and eager for spiritual life. So this eagerness for spiritual life, I take as something very prominent here in Maharaj Rahugana and very important. There's other places where Prabhupada said that one can receive the mantra if one's eager to receive it, that's the main qualification. This eagerness for something more than material life. Next thing Prabhupada said is be prepared to accept any condition in order to associate with devotees. And Prabhupada gives the example about how he has disciples who came from rich families but were living in great austerity in a temple in order to associate with devotees. And of course, that's actually what we experienced when Prabhupada was here. You know, in those days, in the 60s and 70s, joining ISKCON meant that you dropped out of school, you left your job, often you left your family, you lived in an ashram where, I mean, today, you know, in like here in New Goloka, in the men's ashram, so each man gets his own room, and everyone has a bed and a chest of drawers and a desk, and they have internet. And you know, in the 70s, at least when I joined, it wasn't like that at all. It was a bare room, and we just put a sleeping bag on the floor. We didn't even have a mat to put under our sleeping bag. We had like a box or a milk crate to keep our stuff in. You know, maybe there was a shelf. And everybody's stuff looked like everybody else's stuff. I mean, the only personal stuff you had was underwear, but, you know, everybody's saris looked the same. They were just from the fabric shop, just a bolt of saffron cloth. You know, we had our own shoes, our own toothbrush. You know, but and there was like 10 or 12 people in a room. And then you had this bathroom, you know, with multiple stalls. And, you know, that was, it was, you know, it was austere. I wanted to speak of the devotees who went to preach in India, where they were getting all these tropical diseases and they were living often in rat-infested places. And, you know, it was very austere. I mean, we would eat, we didn't even have plates. You know, we didn't have disposable plates, we didn't have metal plates. We had pieces of wax paper like you'd get at a donut shop, and we just put them on the floor and plop down some wet turmeric and ghee sabji on the sheet. You know, when you were done and you picked up your piece of wax paper, the turmeric stained ghee was on the floor. So that doesn't have to be so extreme. But in other words, one should be prepared to accept anything for spiritual life. And Prabhupada says, specifically prepared for austerity, celibacy, control of the mind, and control of the body. So to be a disciple, one has to be prepared for austerity. Again, I think this is true. If you want to learn anything, you have to be prepared for some austerity. You have to be willing to, you know, sit in a class and do your homework and study the textbooks or, you know, show up at the woodworking shop. There's some austerity. And why control of sex life? Because sex is the most entangling way that we identify with our body. And control of the mind. This is the aspect of Jnana Yoga. Control of the body, that's the aspect of Karma Yoga. So control of the mind means becoming detached from the material thoughts and feelings. Control of the body means acting according to our particular dharma that's designated by our ashram and our varna. For control of the mind, Prabhupada quotes, Matra sparsas tukante asitas nasukadukada agama payano nichastam satiksha svabharata. This detachment from the mind going back and forth. Then he says separately again, desires spiritual enlightenment. So Prabhupada listed this first as losing interest in material enjoyment and eager for spiritual life, and then desiring spiritual enlightenment. He also says one should be very inquisitive, which of course relates to 434 in the Bhagavad Gita, Tadvani Pranipratena, Pari Prashnena, that one should be asking questions, that one should be inquisitive. Of course, Prabhupada says, absurd inquiries are condemned. we shouldn't ask questions just for the sake of asking questions. We shouldn't ask questions generally. We shouldn't ask questions where we already know the answer, unless we're in some group of people too shy to ask their real questions, so we set an example. But we should ask questions that we really want to know the answer to, and to enliven the speaker and so forth. Following instructions, wow, that's a big one. You know, that's how we show our eagerness, isn't it? To what extent do we actually follow the instructions of our spiritual master? And sincerely engaging in the Lord's service, pariprashnena sevaya, to actually do seva. So we see in Maharaj Rahugana many of these qualifications. He's realizing his over-attachment to material life. He wants spiritual life. He's prepared to undergo some difficulty. He's very inquisitive. He's going to be following instructions. So we can look at all of this to examine ourselves. I've noticed that there's a strong growing tendency of hyper-examination of gurus and potential gurus. So that's a good thing. One is supposed to examine one's guru, without a doubt, but there should also be great examination of ourselves as disciples or potential disciples. I mean, it's whether or not enlightenment takes place is not dependent just on having a bona fide guru. It's not that you have a bona fide guru and he just, like, you know, waves a magic wand and goes poof, you know, blessing dust from his lotus feet and poof, you're enlightened. But one must also be a good disciple. So again, let's just go briefly through the list of what we want. So we want to have not so much attachment to the material world. In other words, a willingness to give up our material designations, to work in the world as a servant of Krishna rather than designating ourselves. Not so much detachment that we're unwilling to cultivate spiritual thoughts and feelings. Detachment from material thoughts and feelings, but not detachment from spiritual thoughts and feelings. We see this problem, by the way, in members of our sanghas. Then to have faith based on not just dry logic, and taste, a taste that's not just dry logic. We're not going to convince ourselves or others merely with philosophy and logic, but a real taste, a real ruchi. Then eagerness for spiritual life. Losing interest in material enjoyment and eagerness for spiritual life. Being prepared to accept any condition to associate with devotees. A willingness for austerity, celibacy, detachment from our mind, pious activity for our body. Really desiring spiritual enlightenment. Being very inquisitive appropriately. Following instructions. And seriously engaging in service. So what we'd like to do today with this brief class is to examine ourselves. Is there some area here where I need work? Am I still too attached to my designations? Am I too detached so that I can't develop my emotions for Krishna? Do I have some taste? Do I have some faith? Do I have some eagerness? Do I have some inquisitiveness? Am I willing to undergo some difficulty in order to become enlightened? And am I willing to follow instructions? I know one devotee that his spiritual master normally is in another part of the world, but his spiritual master was visiting, and he said in some city not too far, I mean, he would have had to travel. And he said to me, Irmila, do you think I should go see my spiritual master? I said, of course. And he said, well, I'm afraid he'll give me an instruction I won't want to follow. So maybe I'll stay home. That's what he did. He stayed home. All right. We can have questions, comments, additions, subtractions, chastisements.
Irmila Didi. Vandavats.
Hi, Krishna.
I'm jumping in here. Great class. seven or eight points Srila Prabhupada makes, are those Rupa Goswami's, or are those all in one place?
The points that Prabhupada is making are in the purport to NOI verse 5. So my first part of the class, I was focusing on Rupa Goswami's points, which are in 1-15, and I have to pull this back up again. I think it was 1-14. So let me just 45. It was 1-1-44 and 45 of Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, and 1-2-14 and 15 of Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, and Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur's commentary. In 1-2-15 of Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, Rupa Goswami is just quoting Bhagavatam 11.20.8. And then the second half I was referring...
11.28 is... That's Bhagavatam.
Bhagavatam, Canto 11, Chapter 20, Text 8. And,
the whole chapter.
That whole verse.
The whole chapter.
No, that verse, just verse 8. Chapter 20. Chapter 20.
Oh, 11.
11.
Not 20.
20. 8.
Yeah.
And then right. The second half I was referencing Srila Prabhupada's purport to Rupa Goswami's Upadeshamrita text 5, which is where Rupa Goswami is talking about the different levels of devotees. He's talking about the beginner just chants Hare Krishna, and the intermediate has diksha and is worshipping the deity, and the most exalted has no propensity to criticize others and is engaged without deviation. So Prabhupada has a whole section where he's talking about diksha, and he's talking about the qualifications for being a disciple. So what I was quoting from Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu were the qualifications for taking up Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti. And what I was quoting from the purport to Upadeshamrita text 5 were specifically the qualifications for becoming a disciple, which are obviously quite related, because if you're taking up Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti, at a certain point you want to become a disciple. Is that clear?
So are you saying that you've... organize these seven or eight points from different places in the books?
That was just from those two paragraphs in NOI verse 5 purport.
Okay.
Prabhupada makes about seven or eight. Seven or eight points, and it's in about two paragraphs in that one purport. Plus, there's the points that Rupa Goswami is making, so that was a separate list, although they're related.
Yeah. Anyway, I get a lot out of the class. I'm erring on the side of detachment.
Yes, I think so, knowing you a little bit. Yeah. But either way, it's a problem.
Right.
I mean, what's interesting, Prabhu, is that in Raghunath Das Goswami's Manashiksha, verse 6, which is about the donkey urine bath, so Bhaktivinoda Thakur, that is where we think we're getting purified, but we're not. Because, the donkey urine bath is liquid, so we think it's like a bath. But it's actually burning us. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur, in his commentary, he lists many different ways that can manifest. And one of that is being too philosophical and holding back your emotions. I remember when I was I taught this all over the world for about a year and a half, and at one particular temple, and I remember exactly where it was and everything, but I'm not going to say. But anyway, at one particular temple, one of the temple leaders came up to me afterwards and was very upset about this, and said, we're supposed to be just philosophical. We're not supposed to be emotional. And I see that particular problem is often cloaked in, we don't want to be sahajiyas.
Right.
We don't want to be sahajiyas. We don't want to jump there, which is true. We don't want to be sahajiyas. But it's a masking of the problem of not wanting to give my emotions to Krishna. and to just cultivate right. this detachment from thoughts and feelings on the material level. And we see the other one, the two attached, is very prominent nowadays with a lot of the propaganda about the way Varnashram is being presented. So we're supposed to be doing Varnashram in the Yukta Vairagya thing, that, okay, I got a body that happens to be a male married Kshatriya, so that's what I'm going to do for Krishna, because that's the psychology and body that I have, to, that's what you are, Prabhu. You know, this whole thing that you are a woman, you are a man, you are this, you are that, is the two attached. And it's really karma yoga. I mean, some of these devotees, frankly, are propagating karma kanda, not even karma yoga. So, I see both of these. And we have some small contingent that gets into dhyana yoga. Some, much smaller.
Yeah, no, I get it. And it's like, but sahajism... is neglecting the regs, giving that up, and so one becomes a bad example.
Yes.
You know, and then they bring a bad name to
yes.
The mission.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Sahajism is people that are mission. You know, they're having illicit sex and calling it, you know, Krishna's Rasa Lila. That's Sahajism.
Right. Right.
You know, they're drinking alcohol, they're taking drugs, they're having illicit sex, and they're saying, oh, I'm engaging in Krishna's forest leelas. That's sahajism.
Yeah.
You know, and...
Yeah, that's really bad.
And that's a whole different... I mean, we have some of that too, but not a whole lot. You know, that's... I have run into people who are into that kind of thing. I have. But it's definitely... a minority, and we've been so thoroughly indoctrinated by Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati and Srila Prabhupada, right. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, that it's generally pretty easy to spot that stuff. I mean, if we've been
right.
studying Srila Bhakti Siddhanta's and Bhakti and Srila Prabhupada's books and lectures, it kind of screams at us when people are doing that sort of thing.
Right. Great class.
Thank you, really thank you. And we have something in the chat here
yes.
from Vijay Krishna Prabhu. What is the reason for a conditioned living entity to become interested in spiritual life? Why are we being pushed toward, or maybe we being pulled by whom? So this question is raised in the Madhurya Kadambini, beginning of Madhurya Kadambini by Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur, that how does bhakti begin for the conditioned soul? And he says it's the mercy of the devotees. And there's the same thing Rupa Goswami is saying in 1.145, that there's some association with devotees, some mercy from devotees, but we're responding with a taste. So it's not exactly pushed or pulled. We're responding with a taste. I mean, I had my mother, one of the wonderful things my mother did for me was that she exposed me to a wide range of cultures at a very young age. I mean, we lived in New York City in Manhattan, but she took me to the museums. She took me to the theater and the ballet and the symphony and the everything and all different museums and the libraries. And then, you know, I was traveling overseas starting when I was 3, which was a big deal then. You went over the Atlantic in a propeller plane. And she exposed me to all different sorts of food and all different sorts of people. It was a huge favor she did for me. But I also had to accept that. I remember she would say that, you know, even as a young child, even when I was like 3 or 4 years old, that I was very open to going new places and trying new things. You know, trying new foods. And I had an openness to it. So it's also a reaching out from our side. Like I said, you know, we've just had this experience. The devotees would have kirtan and they would give out prasadam. But people have to have some some openness to that.
But Mother Urmila, this openness is due to what? What is the cause for this openness to exist?
Well, that's you, Prabhu. Jivara Swaroopaya Krishnara Nityadasa. We already have an intrinsic taste. All of us do. And it's just, that's our free will. What's the reason for our free will? How can you explain that? It's already there. We just make that decision. The Association of Devotees gives us an opportunity. The Association of Devotees doesn't really give us a taste or a desire, but it gives us an opportunity.
To choose between bad and good, or good or and bad.
Yeah, without that opportunity, the taste can't really awaken. I mean, it could, theoretically, because it's intrinsic in everyone. So it could, theoretically, without any association of devotees. It's possible. But it's generally, that doesn't happen. Generally, if I'm not aware of a choice, of an opportunity, I can't be attracted to it. It's hard to be attracted to something I have no awareness of.
Of course.
I mean, it's like many years ago, a good friend of mine gave me a present of a solar-powered watch. It was in the 90s. And I really liked it. So when it broke, I bought another solar-powered watch. But that was up to me if I liked it or not. Other people have bought me things I didn't like. That's up to me. You know,
I understand.
Does that make sense?
Of course, of course. Thank you very much, Mother Urmila.
And yeah. Why does some jivas reach out and go yes and others don't? It's free will. It's free will. But yet we can say the cause is the mercy of the devotee. Because without the mercy of the devotee, the jiva has nothing to reach out for.
Of course.
Is that reasonable?
Of course, Mother Urmila. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.
You're so very welcome.
Urmila, Mataji, I know you need to go, but I had a question, but I'll defer it for Jose. Maybe we only have time for him.
Okay, we'll do that, and then yes, I should go. Yes, Jose.
Hare Krishna, Mataji. Thank
Hare
you for
Krishna.
The nice picture.
What's your question?
Yes, Mataji, and thank you, Prabhu, for your kindness. My question was, I have a conflict asking questions. Like, I typically don't know how to ask a question properly, and I get confused between communication and conversation. Do you have any tips on how to answer a good question or how to be a good question asker?
I think that's one of the best questions I've ever heard. I don't think anyone's ever asked me that question before. That's a really excellent question. How to ask good questions. So it's something I haven't really thought about in depth before. I don't have like a ready answer. But the most basic thing is that your questions need to be beneficial for you and for the person you're asking. A nice conversation between Prithu and the four Kumaras, where the discussion is that the questions should enliven both the person asking the question and the person answering the question. So what would be enlivening for you? I mean, one thing that I try to think about is what's most important. I mean, I might get one shot at a question. I was just taking an online course in how to design online courses, and there was about 1,000 people taking the course. Each of us had a personal coach who we could email, and we had a Google Doc that we could share with our personal coach. And then we had once a week meeting, but it was in groups of about 60 or 70 people. And we had an hour and a half. So we were all allowed to ask questions, but the coach would never answer more than one question per class from a particular person. And sometimes he'd say, hey, you asked a question last week, so I'm going to get somebody else. So you only had one question you could ask, and you really had to think, what question would be of most benefit to me? Let's say I have five things I need to work on. Which one could I use the most help with? Which one am I the most concerned about? Which one is going to make the most difference? I mean, sometimes people ask questions that it's just like, what does it matter if you know the answer or you don't know the answer? What good will it do you? You know, so where am I really stuck? Where do I really need help? What's something that will really be beneficial for me? Or sometimes it can be a question that helps us just go deeper into relishing. You know, where we're not really trying to find out an answer in terms of logic or an answer in terms of, you know, what verse does it say this in, although that's significant. But we're just trying to gain more appreciation. I mean, we do have to be careful that things are properly cited. I heard a little recording of one ISKCON leader the other day giving his analysis of something without citing any authority, and I thought, well, his analysis is really nice, but how do I know it's bona fide? And then one should ask questions according to the particular topic that's being taught at the time. Srila Prabhupada didn't like it when people asked questions that were not related to that particular class. And to have faith that, you know, they'll be answered at another time. Another thing is to ask questions of the right person. I mean, I had somebody yesterday in a chat asking me all these technical questions about deity worship. And I said, you know, ask the deity worship minister. Why asking me? This is not my area of service. I mean, I do deity worship every day. But I'm not somebody who's, you know, intimately trained in all of the intricate details and rules. So make sure you ask the right person. You know, if somebody's never raised children, don't ask them how to raise children. And it's just, you know, if they've never been married, then how much are they going to have to say about a good marriage? So the right, and then at the right time, you know, ask questions at the right time when someone actually is able to give the time to you. And I would say another thing is to ask questions honestly. Sometimes people say I have a very short question, but actually they're asking an extremely complicated, deep question that requires, you know, a week to answer. And it's manipulative. You know, you've got 5 minutes or something, or 2 minutes. They're asking you some extremely complicated question. Another thing is I'd say don't ask questions if the answers are readily available and you can research them yourself. This is a habit I find extremely annoying. I have one friend of mine, good friend, who is a writer by profession and regularly asks other people to do his research for him. Regularly. You know, hey, where can I find this verse? Where can I find that verse? And I'm thinking, hey, buddy, get the Vedabase on your computer and look it up yourself. You know, why, you know, at least spend an hour researching it yourself before you go ask all of your friends to research it for you. So that's another thing. I mean, is it something you can just find out? You know, go to the Vedabase or go to the all-knowing Google or whatever and look it up yourself so you don't have to bother other people. So those would be my guidelines. Was that helpful or was there something else you wanted to know?
That was extremely helpful, Mataji. Beautiful. Thank you so much.
All right, and it was a wonderful, wonderful question. Okay, well, thank you very much. I think you're better at asking questions than you know. Thank you very much, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.
Thank you.
Yeah, all praise to Srila Prabhupada. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.